Joining us, as he does each week at this time, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, Mr. Kimball?
Doing what I do every day here. You, meanwhile, bringing the monument to its knees lately.
Oh, yes. It's all about establishing dominance over the monument. But, my friend, never take a climb for granted. Just because you might climb it 10 times one day and then 10 times the next, you can still struggle that day after that. So I didn't do any climbs today. But I've done 25 in 3 days. That's a lot, right?
That is an awful lot, yes. I expect it's not going to happen, of course, because it's the government. But you would think that the city of Boston, the state of Massachusetts, somebody would recognize this accomplishment in some sort of official way.
I've made some progress. One of the park rangers, when I go in, gives me an update on the traffic that had been there like an hour before. He'll say, "Oh, it's a good thing you weren't here earlier. It was all jammed up." And then when I come down, he congratulates me. But yesterday when I went in, you're supposed to get a ticket. I don't bother with this. This other park ranger, I didn't have the ticket, and I kind of just blew past him with like a manly nod, right? That sort of, I'm going on here. And he said, "Okay, whatever." And it's like, really? You're giving me attitude?
Wow.
I am your best, well, for free, customer, and you're a park ranger. Your main thing is to be vigilant and recognize people. You should really know me by now. And I don't think we're meant to be like really great friends like I am with the other ranger.
I think what you do with him is you just get really close to him after that 10th trip down, when it's some of the monument and the after effects are wafting off you, and you share that with him. He'll come around.
Think about this. Eventually, at some point, this monument is going to be a must-see destination on the Colin Fleming Literary Walking Tour.
Exactly.
And how many authors or artists have there ever been where you can go to a place and say, "This nut job did this in here this many times every bloody day"? Oh, and he wrote this story in his head around flight number 2.
Well, there can be a lot of stops on that tour, but that will certainly be one of the highlights.
Yeah, that's definitely one of my go-tos. And if you're ever in Boston, you know what we have a date to do.
And I'd like to think...
Oh, by the way,
yes.
I saw a photo of you today.
Yes.
I'm guessing this is mid-1970s, Kimball? Maybe early
80s, Kimball? Late. I'm going to say 70... somewhere between 78 and 82, probably.
You were rocking the Oscar Wilde haircut, weren't you?
It was that, or as somebody else pointed out, the Farrah Fawcett haircut.
Yeah, well, it looked very feathery. I thought
yes.
to myself, Kimball had really soft hair.
I did, and it would reach a certain length, because I never had long hair. I couldn't get it there, because when it would reach that length that's in the picture, it would just start to curl up, and that was not going to be a good look.
Yeah,
I've recovered. Now it's it's short and all white, so I might go back to that look if I can.
Yeah,
we're talking movies today, as we did last week. We're going to turn the clock back a few more years to 1939, which I think a lot of people look at and recognize, rightfully so, as one of the greatest years in the history of cinema.
It's usually considered the de facto best year, which I think implies a degree of lazy thinking, though. If you go through the full roster of films from that year, yes, there are really choice movies, but it's not like, oh my goodness, this is the annus mirabilis of all of cinema. It's really not. It's solid, and there are, of course, canonical classics, but what I like about it, and that's kind of what we're going to be discussing now, is you have these in-between pictures, these quirky pictures that maybe don't get the level of conversation that Gone with the Wind, of course, does. Well, Gone with the Wind for different reasons these days in its prior 70 years, right? But just these films that can fall between the floorboards if we're not careful. And Turner Classic Movies does a decent job of programming some of these from time to time, but I always like that kind of esoteric picture that we missed the first time around, for instance.
Well, yeah, and some of these I confess to not having seen. Now, one I have seen and I love is another great Howard Hawks film with Cary Grant and Gene Arthur, who was one of my favorite actors from this period, Only Angels Have Wings.
And Howard Hawks really did not like working with Gene Arthur. He didn't dislike her personally, but he found her intransigent as an actor. She just was not very flexible. She wanted to do things, as he put it, the way she wanted to do things, which is the way she had done things with previous directors. And Hawks, people are familiar with Hawks films like Rio Bravo. You have a lot of hanging out. And what you get the sense with the Hawks film is that these actors try different ways to get the largely dialogue-driven scenes to work. And there is a degree of improvisation and feel rather than, it's almost like if you're a classical musician, for instance, and someone tells you to improvise, you don't like that. That makes you very uncomfortable. It's not what they do. And sometimes actors can be that way too. So he had a bit of a problem with her. And later, he would play for her a film after they weren't going to work together again, starring Lauren Bacall. And she would say, according to Hawk, to him, like, oh, that's what you wanted me to do. And I was just too stubborn to do that. But it's a quintessential Hawks film in that, even though it's early in his career, there is this emphasis on duty. Duty trumps your desires. It pulls rank on your feelings for people. You are bound by what Spike Lee would later call doing the right thing based upon your sense of duty and purpose. And it's a film about pilots in a place in the world. It's set in South America, because Hawk said this is really the only place you could set this film, where people at the time, because everyone even flew back then, where you would have these dangerous missions for pilots that they undertook. And so he found this one place where the story could happen, and you have Cary Grant in a very serious role. This is before Cary Grant right. was like funny, winsome guy. He is probably the most sensitive, I would say, of all of Hawks' leading male characters in this particular film.
Also, another great character actor, and actually, a busy 1939, Gene Arthur and Thomas Mitchell did this film and also did Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Thomas Mitchell is very good. One of those people that you might not know the name, but instantly you recognize him when you see him on the screen. He played a drunk a lot of times. And it's a tragic story, and it's also, we have in this very early in her career, it's one of her first pictures, is Rita Hayworth. And
right, that's right.
Fox cast her essentially because he'd never seen anyone who looked like that, which isn't objectifying someone or sexist. Some people certainly just have this screen magnetism, and how could you not say that about the future wife of Orson Welles, certainly. Mm-hmm. But it's an ensemble piece, like all of these Hawks films are, and the flight photography, the planes. Hawks was a pilot himself, and there's this scene where somebody has something very bad happen to them because of a bird hitting a windshield, and Hawks had actually experienced that in his own life. So he was working from within a cradle of his own experience, definitely with this film, and it was a passion project for him. Hawks is very interesting because at this point in 1939, he has never really done a picture like this. He's done the best ever mob picture, I think, in Scarface in 1932. And he did a screwball comedy, Bringing Up Baby, the year before. So it's a pivot to this kind of aerial adventuring and fraternity making was just an indication of how versatile he truly could be.
All right, another great film from 1939. Now, Carrie has seen this one. Somehow I've missed it along the way. I believe it was the last of the series with Benita Granville, Nancy Drew, and The Hidden Staircase.
That's great fun. Benita Granville was about 15 when she played this role. It was the fourth time she was the young sleuth. And she is very... Certain times people who are 15 don't really look 15. Benita Granville was certainly 15 years old, but looked about maybe 26, right? She could have passed for someone of that age. And so she had this weird blend. And you'll see kind of uncomfortable comments about her appearance by people who don't really know her age, and they think that she is someone older playing somebody younger. You'll see things along the lines of, oh, she can really fill a sweater, that type of thing. And she's very peppy, though, which is what you want with Nancy Drew. And she tugs along her boyfriend, who really, you get the sense that he's her boyfriend because she desires it so, but he really likes her. but she is certainly the pacemaker of that particular relationship. And she ropes him into one adventure after another. And this one concerns two women, spinsters, basically, spinster sisters, who live in this house. And there's one of those kind of movie deals where they have to stay in the house a certain number of years to get this inheritance and all of that good stuff. And of course, somebody's going to try to drive them out. And Nancy Drew's father, this is an important thing in these pictures. He's a lawyer. And so she kind of comes to him for his guidance. And he is part of a big reason why these plots work. He sets her down her path and she does her mad, passionate sleuthing. And it's not a gender thing. It's not a male thing, a female thing. You just get this very spirited kind of vim, which I like, because people don't normally care about things. And this Nancy Drew character, she's a great role model in these films, and in this one in particular, because she basically says, go out and do what you want. Do that thing that adds purpose to your life and pull your boyfriend along with you. He'll get caught up in it too.
I did not know this until I was looking online. Apparently, it was remade earlier this year and got terrible, terrible reviews.
It must have, because until today, as much as I love the Nancy Drew books and these films, I didn't know it had been remade. So it makes me wonder if they just thought, we'll just throw some stuff at it here, and it's the feminist era, and this will work, but we won't really try that hard, because I didn't even really see much about it in terms of marketing. I didn't see anything about it, so I couldn't even tell you if that was as bad as that probably was.
I assume it was. We're talking movies here from 1939. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's talk about George Sanders as Simon Templar.
Now, he's a man a bit like you, because he is Mr. Suave, Mr. Urbanity, and I know that's you.
Very smooth
guy. You know the Kink song, right? Celluloid Heroes from 1972. Ray Davies references George Sanders. He says, George Sanders will always have style. And I think he is the cinematic epitome of style. He is the thespian incarnate of a Noel Coward bon mot. He is just that charming. He almost really oozes and drips charm in a kind of unpleasant way. Anytime he can get something in these films, his character, that would seem to be desirable, he is more interested in having the acidulous comment, getting the witty remark out, that kind of thing. And he had a tendency to play these detective types, these thin man types, but in England. And so The Saint in London is him doing that. He's driving down the road, country road, picks up a guy, give you a ride, sure. And before you know it, he is in this web of currency fraud, and there are murders and all of this. But you don't really care about that. There's a form of scene chomping, and I would say that Sanders is so enjoyable because it's like a verbal scene chomping. You just relish his words and his delivery, and sadly, he killed himself. And he killed himself for what I think is a unique reason. I've never heard this before with anyone else. He killed himself because he was bored.
Wow. That's... yeah.
He had done everything that he thought there was to do in life. It's not like he was 104. And he just thought, I wish to try other realms. And so he did. He took his leave of us.
Maybe a hobby would have been a better option, but, it's all about choices.
Principles, I guess.
I guess.
And there
yes.
he was, all gone.
Let's talk about what many consider one of the not just great foreign films, but great films in the history of cinema, Jean Renoir's Rules of the Game.
It's interesting because when we hear the word Renoir, we think of the painter, and we think of the painter as the definitive Renoir. But his son was actually the better artist, and that's not a knock on the father. But I think you could make a reasonable case that The Rules of the Game is the best foreign film ever made. And there are days I think it's the best picture that's been made simply anywhere. It's a kind of comedy of errors with tragic implications. And we were speaking about Airplanes before. It has a very famous beginning of a triumphant pilot landing, and he wants this woman that he loves to meet him at the airfield. And not only is she not there, she is married to somebody else. And it sounds fatuous in a way because we have all of these moving couples in this film and we have cases of mistaken identity. And when you read about it, it sounds loopy. It sounds implausible. But when you see it on the screen, it is truly beautiful. I think it's our most Tolstoy-esque movie of all, because if you read Tolstoy, if you read War and Peace or something, usually in life, it's very true to Tolstoy. That's why it's been remarked that if life wrote a book, it would be something like War and Peace. And normally when someone writes something or there's a film, there's like one or two outcomes that can happen. And you can see them. Is it going to be A or is it going to be B? And life isn't really like that. And I think with the rules of the game, like Tolstoy, you never know where the next thing is coming from. That doesn't mean that it's random, because there is always this cessation. There's always the cause and effect. It's never just dropped in on us. And it's a beautiful film. It's a film of sacrifice, and it's a film of ultimately, in the end, both physical tragedy, something happens in terms of somebody dying, and then also emotional tragedy, because certain people who maybe ought to be together are not going to be together. And again, that's very true to life. And the film was actually shot in this region where Senior Renoir wanted to paint, but he could never quite capture it. So as a kind of gesture, Jean Renoir went there and said, I will make this movie, and I will capture on celluloid what my father never could on the canvas.
It was not at the time either a critical or commercial success.
No, people didn't know what to make of it. And it has a feeling to it, an atmosphere that is its own. And that, again, is true to life. We go to places. We go within someone's home, for instance. And it's not just like a general home, like this is how all homes are. You go into certain homes, and it's like, okay, this atmosphere is endemic, for better or worse, to this particular home and this unit that lives within it. And I think the best films are like that. But if you're looking for something more broad and general, this film could have thrown you for a loop. And there's really nothing like it in all of cinema. It's this melange. It's, I guess now you'd call it like a dramedy. It's a horrible term, but like if you watch it, it's very funny. And yet it's absolutely gutting. And I think people just weren't ready for that at the time. And Renoir had come off some successes. You knew him as the Grand Illusion guy.
Right.
Who's like, war is bad. And then he was all upset when there was a war that broke out after he had made the film that was supposed to stop all war going forward. And it just wasn't like anything. It's unlike any other film Renoir made. It's just this unique work of art that transcends any and all genre. But yeah, the reviews were at best middling.
And did I read that at the time it was, I know, the most expensive French film ever made, but maybe the most expensive film of any kind?
It was. It was. And that goes to show you that he was someone who had enough cachet that there would be money in the coffers to make a film. Now, it's weird because it's also kind of an independent film, and he raised some of the money, so it's kind of like that Orson Welles grassrootsy type of thing. But it was a big-budget affair, and it's very much like Molière in terms of that comedy of errors. And you are at the estate, and there is a groundskeeper, and he's mistaken for this person. There are lavish costumes, in a sense. It has an aspect of the Magnificent Ambersons, and you even have deep focus. And this is 1939.
Mm.
Deep focus was not something that we really saw a lot of at the time. You can spot it in strange places where you would not expect it. Bride of Frankenstein, for instance, in 1935. But what was happening at the level of the cinematography was very different. You had the sense that this was Renoir's, it was his white album. It was, let's put everything into it and see if I can make all of it cohere. And yeah, it cost a bundle and it didn't make much of it back.
And finally, as we look back to films from 1939, one that always makes a list of best films of the year, but you'd like to look at it through a different lens, and that is viewing The Wizard of Oz as a horror movie.
It was written by Noel Langley. Now, I am doing a book that will come out next year on the 1951 English film Scrooge, which is the British version made in England of the A Christmas Carol. And Noel Langley wrote that, and I'm treating Scrooge as a horror film. So I think Noel Langley definitely had horror in his writerly blood. And when you look at The Wizard of Oz, it's very nightmarish. it is like a bad dream that Dorothy, in fact, has. And it's funny, like when you're a kid, you think it goes from black and white to color, right? But it's never in black and white. There's no black and white in the film.
No.
Right? It's that sepia tone that is not, it's faux black and white. So it's, even when it's black and white, it's kind of this dream of black and white. It's not actual black and white. And think about how terrifying parts of it is. You're in the woods. You're on a path. You can go out in a wonderful day in the wilds of Maine, and you're walking through the woods. There's something about the woods, just in general, right? That's a little bit creepy. Along comes somebody or something you don't know, and it's just, it's unsettling. And that's the situation Dorothy is in after you have a witch. It's just classic horror archetype, but not just a witch. Like, we can kind of accept a witch. Maybe Dorothy can accept a witch. But you have a witch that you murder, and there's a house on top of it. It's like, whoa, this is not even normal horror. This is kind of horror itself having an additional dream. And then you have the idea of emotional horror. People so often think, oh, I'm scared of this. I'm scared of the dark. I'm scared of great white sharks spotted off of Chatham or whatever. But I think what we're really more scared of than anything is what we might be lacking in. Do we truly lack courage? Are we not smart enough? These are things that this film asks us directly to inquire about ourselves. These are not comfortable questions. They can be horrifying questions. Meanwhile, you're being stalked by a witch. There are all sorts of flying weird things. And then the man that you have sort of predicated all success and deliverance upon is a fraud, which is just horrible, right? You think, like, if I do this, I take care of this, and I endure, I will be set free. Now, pull the curtain back. It's like, there's a guy standing on a stool. This, he's just pulling some levers in here. So I think it's a very scary film. It might be sort of like a child's version of scary, but sometimes those can be the scariest things that we have.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
Think of fairy tales, how frightening they are when we revisit them later as adults. And I think this is kind of a fairy tale with a wonderful performance by Judy Garland, who doesn't get enough credit as a jazz singer, really, I think. And it's just, again, unlike any other film, but we just kind of accept it as, oh, Yellow Brick Road, some songs. It's like, no, man, this is dark. It's like, It's a Wonderful Life. It's dark. It's suicide.
And this whole idea, a young girl who wishes she could go somewhere else, and what's out there over the rainbow, as kids often do at that age, but then is completely ripped away from her home and family and doesn't know how to get back and has to rely on this trio of very strange beings to get her where she needs to go and all she wants to do. That, to me, is the nightmare aspect, too, is that desire that you have to just get back home.
And don't forget about what home is. She's living in the dirty 30s, right?
Yeah.
And just this very hard scrabble life where when you get, like, pregnant, you have the kid, 50-50 chance you might die, and you're on this sort of, like, dirt farm, and you're poor, and what you're trying to return to isn't very bucolic. It says kind of that notion of be careful of not being in the moment with what you do have. Because if you lose that, you can realize that maybe it wasn't quite as horrible as you made it out to be. But yes, she wants to return home. Home for people isn't necessarily a house. It's a level of security where we feel loved, and we have trust in those around us, and we have that general warmth in our lives. And to have that ripped from us, and it doesn't mean fly off in a house somewhere and see someone pedaling outside on a bicycle, is true horror. And so in the end, to return to the hard-scrabble, dirty 30s farm is a restoration of natural order. It's like, okay, we're fine here. The trees have stopped marching on the castle, and we can just be once again.
Well, and even the fact that the actors, the characters that she knows in her life back in Kansas become these other people in her dream, in that nightmare when she's in the Emerald City, from Mrs. Gulch on through the wizard himself.
Think of how Freudian that is. Think of how ahead of its time cinematically that is. Because there aren't just these random new beings. She is taking old beings from her life, and they're being transliterated into these other forms. That's exactly how the dream nebula really works,
right?
That's what when we think about our dreams the next morning, think like, oh, dream, what does that mean? We can usually come up with some kind of explanation. And the more troubled we are in our lives, the easier the explanation can often be. But it's a very Freudian kind of notion in this film. It speaks to Noel Langley's talents, I think, but it goes very far afield of the original books, and it becomes its own sort of giant set piece with a horror maze. That's really what the actual Yellow Brick Road is.
Right.
It's a maze through a kind of hell space to get back to where you feel secure again. And that's a lot going on for something that plays like, right, you watch it at Thanksgiving, it's like, oh, there it is, red shoes, and there's a lot more. And you think about even like Over the Rainbow, it's kind of a blues. It's a blues song. You could hear somebody like Billie Holiday singing that as well near the end of her life. And there's warmth, but there's a lot of darkness too. But I guess it speaks to the fact that anything worth having, that kind of warmth that we need, is sometimes requires us to go through places that can be overgrown, creepy, and just challenging for us.
Well said, as always, my friend Colin Fleming, talking movies with us here on Downtown. Visit Colin's website, colinflemminglit.com, and we'll check in with you again next week.
Okay, my friend.